Hello, I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is a much-celebrated novelist who recently turned her time and talent toward a memoir. In her book, Blue Plate Special, An Autobiography of My Appetites, Kate Christensen recounts her upbringing in vivid detail. And as for many of us, often those memories revolved around food, sometimes food as an escape from our daily troubles. Well, Kate Christensen joins us this hour to tell us her story, and we invite you to share yours at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or share your comments on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Kate, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Well, why did you decide to take a break from writing novels to do this autobiography?
It seems like a big split, doesn't it, to go to the actual real first-person eye from the novelistic narrative eye. This book was actually 15 years or even more in the planning. When I was in my 20s, I discovered food writing, especially M.F.K. Fisher and Laurie Colwin and Nicholas Freeling. And as the years went on, I kept reading them, and Julia Child's My Life in France and Ruth Reichel. And in my 20s, I was not in a good way. In my late 20s, I had just come out of the Iowa Writers' Workshop with an MFA, thinking that my literary path was set. And sadly, this was not the case. And I found myself floundering and alone in the East Village in a little dump of an apartment, feeling my 30th birthday coming and feeling panicky that I had not even begun to write the novel that I thought I would first publish. Mm-hmm. And so in the middle of these nights when I would wake up with insomnia and anxiety, I would read M.F.K. Fisher or Laurie Colwin, and I would feel instantly comforted and as if everything would be okay. And the topic of food was so immediate and so comforting and took me out of myself and out of my own troubles. And this is something that food had done for me all my life. And the intersection of food and language was always exciting to me and comforting. And these books, the way great novels made me want to write novels, these food books made me want to write a food book because food had been such a lifelong obsession and source of comfort and joy. I thought someday when I'm old enough and I have a story to tell, I would love to offer that same comfort and joy to people with insomnia who need it and who need that sort of sense that they're not alone. And so it really took me until I was about to turn 50 to feel like my life had enough of a narrative arc that I could write a food book using my life as the sort of focal point.
What's your earliest memory of turning to food for comfort?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, food for me is associated so strongly with my mother, of course, from a very early age. And what I remember is her tapioca, which she would serve us before bed as a bedtime snack. Mm-hmm. And she would make this not the large, horrible, fisheye, slippery tapioca, but she would make the little tiny, I guess they ground it up or something, and it was very creamy and very milky and very warm in the stomach. So no matter what was happening in our lives, that bowl of tapioca before bed was always a source of coziness.
Hmm. Well, you know, you opened your book with an early memory of eating at your grandmother's table. Could you recount that story for us?
At my grandmother's table?
I thought that's what my notes have, and I'm sorry if I'm misremembering what I was reading, but someone had served you soft-boiled eggs, and I think you were only 2 years old.
I was 2 years old. This was in our house in Berkeley, California,
okay,
where I was born and raised. And it was our house on McGee Street, and I guess it's McGee Avenue. We always called it McGee Street. And this is a terrible memory, and this is my earliest memory. And this is a memory in which food was neither comforting nor uncomforting. It was
there.
Part of the memory. Mm-hmm. But it's a memory very dark and sad, and really my very earliest memory when we were all sitting at the table, my mother and father and baby sister and I, and I was about two. And my father got up to go to work, and my mother looked at the table, and I looked at it along with her, and it was littered with dirty dishes and egg yolks from the soft-boiled eggs. And she asked him to stay and help her, which triggered some sort of rage in him, and he leapt at her and started hitting her. And then he slammed out the door, leaving us there, and she was crying, and my sister was crying. And in that moment, I felt I was looking at the soft-boiled eggs. So maybe I did turn to the breakfast as comfort, even in that moment. But it was a moment in which, and this book contains many, many dark moments, as well as celebratory and joyful and happy and cozy and heartbroken and, you know, all sorts of feelings go around food. But, I mean, this for me was the defining moment of my childhood when I felt myself split in two and deny a certain part of my appetites, which had to do with being female and needing things and being vulnerable and realizing that, oh my God, if I allow those free rein, look what might happen. Look what happened to my mother. And so although this is a terrible memory, the soft-boiled eggs themselves, and this is the strange and wonderful thing about food. I mean, they continue to be one of my favorite breakfasts, and this memory never tainted the wonderfulness of that dish, which is buttered toast broken into soft-boiled eggs in a bowl and all mixed up.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. A lot of people might have a different reaction. They might make a negative association between a breakfast or that specific meal and the incident that they had just witnessed.
Luckily, my mother, on many subsequent occasions, made that breakfast, and it was far, far more tranquil, let me just say. So I think the fact that my mother provided such stability for us in my childhood and such warmth and nurturing allowed me to kind of, you know, go on eating them.
Well, I think you touched on this a little bit, but you, in your book, you had mentioned that you, in that moment, allied yourself with your father. Could you talk more about what you mean by that?
Well, I think it's in the sense that I was afraid of being treated the way that he had treated my mother, and I mean, at 2 years old, it was a terrifying thing to witness, and I loved both my parents so intensely, and I didn't understand it, and I, you know, to this day, it's hard to understand. Knowing what I know of my father, he was very mild-mannered, you know, and charming and a hero to many people. He was a Marxist lawyer in the Bay Area in the 60s, and he worked pro bono for all kinds of, you know, people who were fighting the fight, like the Black Panthers and conscientious objectors and draft dodgers and Vietnam War people who were protesting the war and got arrested, and people around us saw him as a hero, and he was extremely well liked. And I think this is a pretty typical story of someone who's publicly a hero and then at home is a menacing, complicated presence.
Well, going into your adolescence, did you ever turn to? Did your relationship with food become unhealthy, maybe on account of trying to escape some of these stressors? And by then, though, you had moved away from your father. But could you talk a little bit about that? Had your relationship with food ever become unhealthy?
Oh, I think in high school, when I went away to a private school and worked for room and board, I got a full scholarship and had to leave home because we were living in a tiny town in Arizona. And I felt that I needed a better school. I needed to learn. And the school wasn't providing that. So I got myself out of there and left home at 16, and I was really young for my age. I was not ready to have to work for room and board, and I wasn't ready to be away from my mother, and I wasn't ready to be in this whole new environment. And I think that I turned to food as an adolescent, as many adults. It's like the version of the freshman 20, I think. I definitely mainlined carbohydrates in a way that could be seen as unhealthy. But it was the first time I'd ever had anything like a calzone or a meatball sub. I'd grown up in the West, in the Southwest, where those things didn't exist, and was living in suburban New York, outside of New York City in Rockland County, and just discovering these and Doritos, which I'd never had before. So my animal lust for carbohydrates sort of coincided with this pathological homesickness and conspired to cause me to eat far more than I should have for comfort.
Can I ask you how your body responded to all those foods? I mean, I'm sure you didn't just eat it all at once, but did it revolt in any way?
Of course. My pants got really tight. I gained weight. So then I went on a stringent diet, which I write about in the book, to lose weight. And to my shock, it actually worked. I severely restricted my calorie intake, and lo and behold, I lost weight. And this was when I was 16 and a half. And it was sort of the first time I made any association between what I ate and how I felt or what my body did. It had never dawned on me before that there was any correlation.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Kate Christensen. She's the author of 6 novels, and her latest book, though, is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. And we're wondering, what are your first memories of truly enjoying food, not just for nourishment, but maybe as a sensory experience? Maybe when have you ever turned to food for comfort in your childhood? Are there any old meals your parents used to cook you that you still enjoy today? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Kate, you talked about living in Arizona for a time, and at that time, you said that your family was different from others. Can you talk about that a little bit?
We moved to Arizona in 1970, which is the year I turned 8, because my mother, who had then left my father, had decided to get her doctorate in psychology. She was going to be she became a clinical therapist, and so. Arizona State University in Tempe was the only school that took a single mother with 3 small kids and gave her enough of a stipend to live on. And so we moved to Tempe, Arizona in 1970 from Berkeley, California. And it was a completely different world. It was like moving to the moon. We were, I don't want to say bohemian, but maybe we were, we were very much a part of Berkeley in the 1960s. And that meant sort of politically left. And my mother wore sort of, you know, bell bottoms and chunky jewelry and sandals and had long hair. And when we moved to Tempe in 1970, it was a world of Baptists and Republicans and a lot of cowboys. And the whole atmosphere was completely different. It was very flat and brown and bare. It was not at all as cosmopolitan as it's to come now. It was really, really from another place in time, from Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So we felt completely out of place. I remember one day my sisters and I all ran around naked in Berkeley, as a matter of course. All the kids did. A lot of the grown-ups did. And one day in Tempe, we were going to the market to buy some food, and my sisters hopped in the car. They were like 3 and 5 or something, without any clothes on. It was hot. It was Arizona. Walked into the market naked, and I remember the collective indrawn gasp of horror from all the shoppers vividly. And needless to say, they never went naked in public again. That was a wake-up call. It was like coming out of the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're taken out of that environment that you were used to, you don't necessarily realize that it was any different from others.
No, it was a culture shock all around.
Now, did you keep in touch with your father during that time, and how often did you see him?
I went back the next summer by myself to visit him, and then the following summer, my sisters and I all went. So we saw him during the summer times, and he visited us, as I recall, a couple of times in Tempe, and so we were in touch with him. But then there was another cataclysmic event of domestic violence that I describe in the book. And by the way, these scenes were really hard to write, and they're really hard to talk about because they're things that that are so deeply private. And I feel like writing this book demanded, if I was going to write a book about my life and about food, it demanded all of it. I hadn't intended to expose so much. And it's in a way freeing to write about it, and it's another way... it's very, you know, it adds a layer of vulnerability to the book. Mm-hmm. Because I'm writing about real people, not just myself, but my family and other people that I've known through the years. And after this scene that I described that I think took place when I was 10, or maybe I just turned 11, after which my father was led away in a cop car in handcuffs, we didn't see him again for many years, and he essentially disappeared from our lives. And the last time I saw him, I was 27, which was 23 years ago.
Mm. Is he still alive today?
Yes, he is.
And does he know about this book, and I guess, do you know how he feels about it?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea. I cannot imagine that he's happy that I wrote about it. You know, it's a complicated thing, mm-hmm. writing the truth and writing about what happened. It caused me no small degree of second thoughts and anxiety to write this story. But in the end, I feel strongly that to write the book, I had to. And my editor also insisted. I was trying to pull my punches a couple of times, and he said, no, you have to tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, I did.
Well, thank you for being so open to discussing that on the air with us today. Our guest is Kate Christensen. She's the author of 6 novels, and her latest book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. We're inviting you to our conversation as well. What role has food played in your life, maybe from your early memories as a child up through today? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and we're talking with this hour about food, our relationship with food, and its presence alongside the trials and triumphs of daily life. Our guest this hour is Kate Christensen. She's author of Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. We invite you to join our conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or tweet us at @KDunnShow. Kate, you wrote that to taste fully is to live fully. Can you tell us more about what you mean?
I think that there is no hiding in food. I think that is part of that same paragraph. Or there can be no hiding in food. And I think that food possesses this uncanny power. It's part of all our daily lives, and it's something we all share. And it's something so powerful in everyone's memory, I think. And I wonder if the food part of the brain and the memory part of the brain are right next to each other. And I wouldn't be surprised if they were, mm-hmm. Because I feel that food is so much a part of all my memories. It's intertwined and tied into everything. Falling in love, and eating with a person you've just fallen in love with is so sensual and so pleasurable and so exciting. It's almost better than sex. Well, not quite.
Well, you know, taste is so close to smell. I mean, when we're eating food, we're also smelling it, and it is truly a sensory experience. And I know that that smell is one of the foremost senses associated with memory. So I think you're onto something there.
That's exactly right. And taste and smell are so close. I feel like to be confronted with a plate of food is to be, once when I'm enjoying a plate of food and eating a meal that's delicious and that pleases me on some level, with someone I love or alone or in a group, I feel like I'm fully present in a way that I'm not always. And in that moment of tasting something, I'm right there and experiencing the taste of the food and the textures and everything around it completely with sort of all of my attention and all of myself. And I think that when I've eaten, and times when I'm really upset, I can't eat because it just intensifies whatever I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think that food has its dangers because it can be, for people who love food, I know that not everyone is like this, although it's hard for me to believe, but for people who really love food, I think that it conjures up so many things. In addition to memories, just sort of sensory experiences and emotions and language. I think that food and language are also really intertwined, and I think that's why food writing is such a beloved genre and so comforting.
When did you first wake up to the fact that that eating was a passion for you? It wasn't just something you did to stay nourished, but that it truly was an experience to savor and behold.
I remember when I was 8, and it was the year we moved to Tempe. I mean, I'd always loved food, and my favorite meal as a little kid before I turned 8, when I was younger, and what I always asked for on my birthday was hot dogs, creamy corn, and boiled carrots. And it was, everything was very sweet, obviously. There was a lot of sugar in that meal with ketchup and whatnot. But, I mean, I loved it, but it wasn't, I hadn't, my palate hadn't woken up yet. But the year I turned 8, I remember I suddenly became just fiercely excited about food. I would read the school menu, and this again is the intersection of language and food. I would read the school menu and I would see Sloppy Joe's up ahead on Thursday, and it was only Monday, and I would already start drooling with anticipation for those Sloppy Joe's. So I think something happened that year. Maybe it was moving to Tempe. Maybe I just got old enough and my palate developed and my tongue learned to sort of get excited about taste in a way that it hadn't been before. But I used to sit, my sisters joke about this. They're both younger than I am. I used to sit at the dinner table. If my mother had made something particularly good, which she often did, I would look up with a fierce expression. My sisters have called it feral, and say yum, with a kind of intensity that they said made them a little nervous. So I think that food was maybe more intense for me than anyone else in my family, and it became something of a joke.
Well, and your mom had a certain style of eating, especially corn.
Yeah. Well, first, my mother's the slowest eater I've ever met in my life, and I described her eating in the book, and I described her eating as if, for her, there's no narrative flow to a meal. She eats more like each bite was a poem, and for me, there's a story, and I would sit and shovel the food into my mouth and allow the narrative to keep going until the meal was done, which I think most people do. But my mother would sit very calmly, take a bite, chew it, swallow it, get caught up in the conversation, laugh, as if she had forgotten about her food, and I would watch her in astonishment, like, how could you ever forget there's a plate of food in front of you? And then she would take another bite a little later on, and it would take, she can really take 45 minutes to eat a plate of food, something I admire greatly.
By then it's cold, isn't it?
I don't think it matters. Actually, my youngest sister is exactly the same way. I think she must have inherited that.
Hmm. Well, tell us about the title that you settled on for your book, Blue Plate Special. Where did that come from?
That was always going to be the title. Even in my 20s, when I thought of writing a food book, that was my provisional title. My mother used to make us, well, when we all were living at home and eating dinners together every night, she used to make the sort of, you know, meat and a starch and a veg or two, and we would exclaim over it because she was a good cook. And it could be meatloaf and mashed potatoes and peas, or a fillet of fish and rice and green beans or something like that. And we would say, "Oh, so good!" And she would say, "Oh, it's nothing but a blue plate special." And she was referring to those diner meals that she used to eat in the 50s. She would save up for them as a starving student when she was living in New York, and she would go and have a blue plate special, and they were always, you know, I mean, in diners, they were sort of gray meat and overcooked vegetables and you know, nothing like the meal she made. But for me, this association was so comforting. It was always later in life I would think, I'm making a blue plate special, and it was sort of in honor of my mother's cooking.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shirley, I'm sure she made some food that you didn't like. What were some of those foods, and how would you get around eating them if you could?
Of course, the flip side of having an intense love for food is having an intense reaction to food that I hate. And of course, as a kid, there's always the disgusting stuff that you like, liver, that you can't even fathom eating, and you have to choke down somehow. but it wasn't just liver; it was also lima beans and okra, and certain gristly pieces of steak. It was the 70s, and we didn't have a lot of money, so my mother would buy the cheaper cuts of meat, and they often had gristle in them, and there was something about gristle that just caused this sort of, you know, desire to spit it out and give it to the cat, which I did. Thank God for the cat.
There, yes. And, well, you know, that makes me think of another story you tell in your book. You ate dog biscuits.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what led to that?
Well, this is another sad memory associated with my father. When my sisters and I were all staying at my father's house in Oakland in the summer of 1972, His girlfriend had a couple of sons, and the older son decided that he and I were going to rob the house next door. He was a delinquent in training, I think. And so his name was Elijah, and Elijah and I went into the house next door and stole $40 and some costume jewelry and then came running out. And afterwards, we felt so guilty and weird that we sat under the staircase of my father's house on the outside with a bag of dog biscuits, because we thought this was the fitting punishment for hardened criminals. It was like prison food. Like, we put ourselves in prison and gave ourselves prison food. And we ended up putting everything on my father's bureau and sort of walking away from it, which is sort of the end of the story in a strange way.
Mm. Well, we have some callers waiting for you, and let's talk to them. We've got Renee in Westfield. Hi, Renee.
Hello. Hello, Kate, and thanks for taking the call and having this program. I feel like maybe we could be a kindred spirit here. When I hear you speak, so many of these things resonate with me, even down to the okra, lima beans, liver, and grizzle. Grizzle was something that made me turn vegetarian for a good long time of my life, actually, and for the same reasons. But my comment was just that I feel like my family has been in this constant food fight, just with ourselves, each personally, and with our children as we've grown up, trying to get a real healthy outlook on food. Yet we all have deep, wonderful, rich, lovely food memories from having, you know, a grandmother who was a French pastry cook and had some of the best meals, you know, that one could hope for. All of our grandmothers cook wonderful, of course, we think, just because we associate those food memories in growing up. So my simple comment was just thank you for writing the book. I'm just delighted, and I really am looking forward to reading what I'm guessing is going to be a real rich and lovely experience. So thanks for being open and sharing and all those things.
Thanks, Renee.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that.
Let's go next to Katie in Madison. Hi, Katie.
Oh, hi. Yes, I too have enjoyed the program. It's been very interesting, and food is a sensory thing as far as smell and taste, and evidently it goes on down through the system and you're still experiencing it. I had a grandmother, a Danish grandmother, who made rhubarb pudding, which was pretty much bright red, and then she'd spread some white cream on the top of it in a design. And as a two-year-old child, it was like, wow. And that was a very wonderful experience. In fact, all my food experiences have been pretty good, except my father would insist that I would eat my mother's oatmeal, which was mushy. And as a child, the sensory in the mouth was really pretty yucky. So I'd put it in the cold register behind me, because he'd go upstairs and he'd say, when I get back down, that oatmeal better be gone. And so I'd dump it into the cold register behind me. Years later, he said he cleaned it out and found a whole bunch of dried oatmeal.
Oh, no. How much had built up by that time?
Evidently quite a bit. But I was not a big oatmeal fan until I became an adult. And then I was pretty into it once I learned how to make it correctly.
Thanks for that story, Katie. Kate, I'm wondering, when did you start cooking for yourself?
I learned to cook and learned to eat in restaurants pretty late in life. And I think that's another reason why I wanted to write this book. I worked for room and board, in high school for 2 years, and then in France as an au pair girl, and I had to learn to cook then, because I was cooking for families. But I didn't really know how. I just learned to make the meals that the mothers in the houses taught me to make. And some of those were really good. But I had no instinctive idea of how to improvise in the kitchen or how to follow a recipe or really anything to do with food. And then I went off to college and graduate school and, of course, subsisted on bean burritos and ramen and stir fries. And then moved to New York and had those years when I was floundering and reading food books. But I wasn't actually eating anything while I was reading those food books. I was actually starving. I was very thin. I rarely ate. I was too nervous, I think. And I didn't know how to eat in restaurants. And I remember, I mean, it's so curious to me now, all these years later, walking by a bistro or a good Italian restaurant and looking at the people inside eating and looking at what they were eating and looking at the menu on the window and thinking, I could never go in there. I didn't know how. And we weren't raised going to good restaurants because we were poor. And to me, this was a barrier. It was almost like, it felt to me like a class thing. Like, I had not ascended yet, culinarily anyway, to the American middle class. And I was sort of stuck on the outside looking in until I met my ex-husband. And he was someone who understood that you were allowed to go into restaurants, that anyone could do it. And he knew how to cook. And so I think it was really once I got married, and the two went hand in hand for me, learning how to eat, learning how to cook, learning how to eat in restaurants. That was when the whole panoply of food in New York became open to me. And I kind of had with him an orgy of food, during the years of our marriage. We really, eating was our passion together, the thing that we shared. And we ate everywhere and we ate everything. And, I started cooking, it was a challenge because he was a much better cook than I was. And that, you know, I'm competitive and I thought that's not okay. So I taught myself to cook. I subscribed to Cook's Magazine. I got Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything. I started paying attention in restaurants to how dishes were presented and prepared and the combinations of ingredients. And I started, really for the first time, thinking about food as a creative thing, and at the same time I was blossoming as a writer. I'd started to publish novels, and so a lot of food found its way into all of my novels. And then finally I wrote this book, which is, you know, I can say it's a food book. I didn't have to sneak the food in. I could make it front and center. But it all went together for me, writing and cooking and eating.
Do you still enjoy eating out? And would you say you eat out more often than you cook, or vice versa?
That's hard to say. I moved to Portland, Maine, a year and a half ago, and there are amazing restaurants here. I had no idea when I moved here. It just seems like a completely lucky coincidence. Eating out has, my now boyfriend and I, we've been together the last 4 years, have discovered this sort of three blocks away from our house, we have this little group of restaurants that we love to go to. And mostly, though, we cook at home. And we're both really passionate cooks. And we like to cook together, which is a whole other thing, a whole other nice thing, cooking with someone as a sort of dance in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. It can be klutzy or it could be graceful. Depends on how well you've got it mastered, right? My guest is Kate Christensen. She's the author of 6 novels, and her latest book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetite. And she joins us for the remainder of this hour. We invite you to join our conversation as well. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Taking your questions and comments, wondering maybe what's your favorite midnight snack? We'll get some hints from Kate as well. She often would sneak downstairs at night to fix herself some soup, and we're going to get that recipe from her as well. Maybe you'll enjoy a midnight snack on account of her help here. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this hour with Kate Christensen. She's author of Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. And we're inviting your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Kate, just before the break, I mentioned that you had one of your favorite midnight snacks was a sort of butternut squash soup. Is that right?
Well, it's called Dark Night of the Soul Soup, the recipe in the book. And it's not actually a literal thing that I go downstairs and eat. This is from the introduction of the book, and it's during those dark nights of the soul when I wake up and I feel all my past faux pas and failings rising before me. And there are many, and they go all the way back to the beginning. And, you know, they can be overwhelming in those wee hours. And I start to get anxious about having said something wrong at a party 10 years ago or not, or failed to do something for my grandmother who is dead and there's nothing I can do about it now. I start thinking about food. And I don't get up and go downstairs and eat. I lie in bed and I think about what's downstairs in the kitchen and what I might make. So it's a hypothetical midnight snack, actually. But so I call it Dark Night of the Soul Soup, and I say, let's say hypothetically there's some butternut squash and some garlic and some goat cheese and some chicken broth and some apples, and I think about a soup I could make if I roast everything and then puree it and add the cheese at the end, and I'm instantly asleep as soon as I start thinking about that. So it's a sort of midnight. I mean, it's a daydreaming, night dreaming midnight snack.
Got it. Well, Pam in Madison has joined us. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I love the conversation, and I do a particular kind of research that I've invented to understand that appearance, bite, chew, flavor, and aroma all have their own psychological effects, and I've quantified this over time. So you as a food person, the minute you see something, you know how it's going to feel. And that's what excites you. And so all of the feelings that are embodied on a plate with the different textures and the different appearances are a promise of particular feelings to you. And your night experience of blocking out thoughts and picturing this particular lovely smooth soup, you're actually blocking out thoughts in your left brain and using your right brain to comfort yourself.
I am so glad you explained that to me. That makes so much sense. It does feel that way. It feels like I'm switching to another part of my brain to shut up the part of my brain.
And what your mother was doing at the table with her bite and talk, is actually the more European style of eating. It's not that French women are thin because they eat less. It's that French women are thin because they talk more.
Well, my mother isn't French, but she'd be very flattered to hear this. she is very thin.
Well, and I've heard that the slower you eat, it takes your body a little bit more time to feel full relative to how quickly you're putting food inside of your body. So if that makes sense. Or in other words, if we eat too fast, we don't feel satiated quickly enough.
Apparently, it takes 20 minutes for the brain to understand that the stomach is full.
Mm.
Yeah. I worry about my dog because I put his food down in front of him. He's a former street dog, and this may have something to do with it. And I put a nice amount of food in front of him, and it's gone in 5 minutes, and he's still hungry. And I tell him to wait 20 minutes, although he doesn't really understand.
Yeah, how does that work?
About.
Yeah. Well, Pam, thank you so much for calling. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Kate, do you have any guilty pleasures when it comes to food?
Well, I would say potato chips and French fries are probably my guiltiest pleasures, and those are pretty guilty. I mean, it's sort of pure starch and fat, and I can easily eat a bag of potato chips in one sitting. I don't let myself do it as often as I want to, or very often at all, but when I do it, I really let myself do it, and I really savor it. And I would have more guilty pleasures, but I can't eat gluten. And so that cuts out a whole species of those treats that are purely bad for you. But when I could eat gluten, I had a real passion for Hostess Ding Dongs, which are just insanely delicious, and Dunkin' Donuts, chocolate honey dipped in particular, and meatball subs that are just dripping with fat and meaty goodness and on soft white Italian bread. I would say those are the top five.
And what would you eat on your birthday, for example, when you were younger?
As a kid?
Yeah. Didn't your mom take you to McDonald's or something?
Yeah, definitely McDonald's. And I always had two McChicken sandwiches because one was never enough, probably because I wolfed it down and 20 minutes hadn't gone by, so I had no idea that I'd eaten anything. And a large fries and a chocolate shake and then a hot apple pie, which I always ate when it was too hot. So my memory of those McDonald's birthday dinners was the hot apple pie stuck to the roof of my mouth afterwards. But it's a pleasurable memory. It was the good kind of pain.
Tasty. Yeah. Well, you know, summer's a great time for camping. You write a little bit about your favorite camp foods. Could you share some memories there?
Oh, it was so delicious, too. And it's going to sound really, I think it doesn't sound good, but when you're a kid, this sort of thing is just memorable. Part of it was we went camping a lot as a family, and we ate around the campfire often. And when we would go to Mingus Mountain in Arizona, and I have this great memory of sitting around the campfire. We'd eaten our hot dogs, and then my mother, thinking that we needed some vegetables, because she was always conscious of getting vegetables into us in any way she could, would open a can of peas, and we called them camping peas. And we would pass this can, and it was sort of, you know, room temperature, outdoor temperature, whatever the temperature was. We mm-hmm. didn't cook it. And we would pass it around with a spoon, and we would slurp up these very soft peas in this sweet syrup. They were delicious. I mean, I haven't eaten camping peas in years. I wonder if I would be disappointed now. I almost don't want to. But back then, we would, you know, we could, my whole family between us all could put down a couple of cans. We all really liked them.
Wow. What was the syrup made of?
I have no idea. I mean, they must have put sugar in it.
Huh.
Maybe the peas were so sweet. But canned peas, I think, they're not like frozen peas. They're soft. They sort of melt in your mouth.
Right.
They're almost like fruit. Or so I recall. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
No, they're mushier, I would say.
Yeah, mushy. And, you know, I went to Australia a while back, and I had a pie, a meat pie with mashed potatoes and something called mushy peas on top. And that was the closest thing to those camping peas that I ever had as an adult. And they were indescribably delicious, just as sweet as I remembered and just as mushy.
Well, how has your relationship with food evolved over the years? You wrote about how for some years early on it was a source of comfort. Do you still find that's true today, or is it different now?
I find myself in need of much less comfort now because, I think that my relationship to food is really, food is sort of what you make it. Like those soft-boiled eggs that I now enjoy every winter, you know, several mornings a week, that same breakfast mm-hmm. that I had when I was two. But now it's a source of, you know, I eat it in domestic harmony and happiness and settledness at 50. And I think that my relationship with food, and that's why it's subtitled An Autobiography of My Appetites, has been rocky, definitely, and complicated, I think. And I think that what I had to do was integrate my appetites and feel as if I were in control of them instead of letting them control me or needing something from food that it really can't provide, in order to feel that I now eat for nourishment and pleasure, which sounds so simple, but it's really been a long time for me to, you know, as a late bloomer, I have to say. It took me a really long time to learn to do that. And I think in order to do that, I needed to establish a sort of a happy life for myself mm-hmm. and to eat out of happiness and out of a sense of just enjoyment.
You had spoken earlier about sort of the tough times with regards to your father and home life when you were with him, and even afterwards when your family had moved to Arizona and you'd gone back to visit him. But I'm wondering how your relationship with your father and maybe some of the things that you had witnessed as a child affected your relationship with men later in life.
Oh, it has to have. Yes, it certainly did. And I think that I didn't. That scene, and again, when I say it was hard for me to talk about, I think it was hard for me to identify with the fact that I was affected by that scene. I tried so hard all my life to pretend that it had nothing to do with me, that my father had hit my mother, not me, and she was the one who was hurt, not me, and she needed my protection and sympathy, but I didn't need that from anyone. And I tried to be so tough because of it all my life. I'm not sure that's answering your question. Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any expected answer in mind. I just went, that's an interesting thought, you know, because a lot of people are affected by early memories in their childhood and carry that with them into their adult life, whether it's conscious or subconscious. So I was just curious.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I think that in my relationships with men, it was very hard for me ever to be vulnerable and to need anything, and therefore to really connect, because I think that connection comes when you're fully able to articulate these things and in some sort of way aware of them and allowing them to exist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that also took me a while. And I can trace it back to my mother's relationship with my father. It seems like there's definitely that it did affect me far more than I ever thought it did. And this came back to haunt me in my late 40s when it finally all sort of came to a head in my marriage. And I realized, yes, this did affect me, and I have to admit it. And I can't go on thinking that it didn't. Even if in saying that it did affect me, it means that I have to make myself vulnerable and actually talk about it. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, these things are all tied up in appetite somehow. And you know, the most intimate things in our lives, I think, come into being when we're eating or you know, relating to food.
Let's take one last quick call from Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I've never met anybody who has the relationship with food that I do. I honestly can say I'm basically afraid of food. I can't really think about it, and I sort of approach feeding myself the way people approach paying their taxes or balancing their checkbook. And what happened with me was I had one parent who we had most of our school year with basically didn't pay attention to how much food there was in the house. Even if she had money, there was often not enough to eat, and we were eating whatever we could microwave. And she cooked once a year. And then my other set of parents, I would go to their house and I would get picked on for my manners because, of course, for most of the year I wasn't being supervised while I ate. So it just is like, okay, the dinner table is bad because that's where I get picked on. And on the other hand, we just don't have enough food. So now I pretty much I try and buy a lot of fruit because that's my happy food. When I was a kid, I could walk around the neighborhood and pick fruit off trees, and it was something it was completely independent of adult control. I could actually get my own food. So I'm sort of a fructivore now.
Thanks so much for sharing your story, Kathleen. Do you have any thoughts on that, Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes to the heart of what we were just talking about, and I'm so sorry to hear that. That there should be any trauma around food is really sad, and I'm sorry.
Well, Kate, are you still maintaining a food blog? That was the sort of the genesis for this book. I'm wondering if people can still track your writing online.
I sure am. I'm blogging periodically, and just for the pleasure of writing about food, because it's one of the most fun things I know of. And so, I post from time to time. I'd like to post more often, and I'd like to start as soon as things settle down and I have time again.
Mm-hmm. And where can people find that information?
It's katechristensen.wordpress.com. I think it's com. I should know.
That's okay. Well, tell us once again, where will you be in the Midwest? Some people are wondering if you will be coming to Wisconsin to do any readings from your book or anything like that.
Oh, I would love to come to Wisconsin. I've never been there, and I hear the most wonderful things about it, really, truly. But I have no plans to go now, but if anyone wants to invite me to give a reading there, I would love to.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. That was a very interesting and great conversation.
Thanks, and good luck to you. Our guest has been Kate Christensen. She's the author of 6 novels, and her latest book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. We invite you to stay tuned to the Ideas Network. Later tonight, we have a Q with Gian Gomeshi. His guest this week is writer and broadcaster Gil Deacon. And it's an archive from The Best of Q that's coming up at 7 o'clock on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And please join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about immigration legislation, why that hasn't really gotten off the ground here in the United States, and with the gridlock in Congress. That's tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And after 2 o'clock, we're looking at the new economy and what that means for things like job sharing and employment. I'm Cynthia Schuster. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for production. This is the Ideas Network.